The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Blue Cliff Record, Case 45. A monk asked Zhaozhou, "The 10,000 dharmas return to one. Where does the one return to?" Zhaozhou said, "When I was in Qingchao, I made a cloth robe. It weighed 7 pounds." In the verse, "You brought a piece of logic to trap the old gimlet. But do you know the meaning of the 7-pound cloth robe? Now I have thrown it away into Lake Seiko and sail before the wind. Who will share the coolness with me?" We've been looking into this wonderful koan together, the Sesshin. To me, a classic koan, classic in that it follows this form where a student presents himself, herself, to a teacher, and a teacher responds. This call and response. These koans are these wonderful devices, wonderful places that we can go with our practice. They are set up in a way that help us see that we quite often use maps to look at reality. We have many, many mental maps, many ways of seeing the world. And these are important. They help us navigate our lives. We could call them prejudices. We could call them heuristics. We could call them just the way we see it. And they work for us until they don't. And when they don't, there's suffering. These koans have been a wonderful, frustrating journey into my practice. And if you've taken up a koan or two or many, maybe they've been the same for you. I really appreciate yesterday David's talk when he asked us to dream into the character of the monk. Dream into the characters. Dream into the koan. It can be very easy to look at a koan, a story like this, and place it outside of us. Something to reach. Something that holds a clue to our life. Something that's beyond us that we have to grasp. And honestly, that's how it's sort of set up in our koan curriculum here at Boundless Way and at other Zen practice places. There seems like a gradual graduation from one to next, one koan to the next. And there is. And yet we can look at each koan as a way, a doorway into our own life. These characters, the monk and Zhaozhou, over 1,000 years in a place thousands of miles away, are right here. This monk is us. And even though we look at Zhaozhou, one of the most famous, well-known Zen masters, he's us too. Your everyday functioning is no different from his functioning, from the functioning of the masters and the Buddhas. So how can we look at this koan in a way that brings it home, so to speak? For me, this monk, I see so many aspects of myself there. On the one hand, sitting before a teacher, someone who I respect, admire, can be intimidating. It can change my relationship to others. I may, in some instances, want to present myself in a certain way. Maybe you do too when you meet a teacher. Maybe you want to present how much you know or qualify what you know. It's very difficult to sit before a teacher and open up yourself, risk looking like or feeling like an idiot. That takes enormous courage. And I don't always have that courage. Maybe you don't either. And that's okay. That's part of the way, part of the journey. And Zhaozhou, how can you relate to Zhaozhou? This Zhaozhou, one who said Mu. For those familiar with koans, this is the first koan that most of us take up. Does a dog have Buddha nature? The monk asks. And Zhaozhou said Mu. How is Zhaozhou like us? He may be more us than we are us. A man, certainly with an incredible reputation, but still a human being who breathes, who eats, who shits, and who dies, just like us. And these two meeting together, we can look at what's being said. The 10,000 things return to the one. What does the one return to? We can look at that as a call to the world. What is this? What's going on here? Who am I? At some level, we all have that question if we really look deep. You know that. But we can tend to paper it over, like maybe this monk did, with a really esoteric, vague phrase about oneness and the 10,000 things. Or maybe that's all he had with him at that moment, just to say something. In Zhaozhou's response, when I was in Qingchao, I made a cloth robe. It weighed 7 pounds. How random a response, right? It sounds like a non sequitur. It sounds so zen. But maybe it's speaking from the heart. Maybe it's what arising for Zhaozhou. There is nothing random. One of the great teachings of Buddhism, of the Buddha, is that everything is the cause of everything else. Something that is so beyond our intellect. Everything. But luckily, we don't have to worry about everything. We can just be concerned with this. Because this is everything. A student coming up to a teacher, asking a question, a teacher responding. You are a student, and you are a teacher. Your questions are questions of the human race. Your answers are the answers of the human race. How do you teach? Chopping vegetables? Hitting the bell? Gassho to the Buddha? Laying out your utensils? That's how you teach. And how do you learn? You can certainly study the words of Zen and Buddhism. But we do cover the books in the library for a reason. In my role as the director of the temple, one of the things I do is I answer inquiries. People will call the temple phone. I have an answering machine there, and I will usually respond within 12 hours. And people more likely go through our contact us page on our website. And on the phone, roughly 75% are spam. And of the 25 left, some people want to know, are you still open? When do you open? And half of that, they have some questions about what we're doing here. The same thing online. Roughly 50% are you still open? Can I come visit? And the other 50 are questions. What are you doing here? I heard about Buddhism. What can you teach me? How can I learn about what you're doing? Do you have any books you can recommend? Do you have any classes? And my general response is to show my appreciation for their inquiry, because I do. I do appreciate it. And then I turn them to our practice. I say, come sit with us. Come sit. Meditation, Zazen, is what we do here. You can read all the books about Zen you want. And it's fun and interesting and informative. But here's where it all comes to be. Right here, sitting. Sitting in the middle, in the midst of our lives. sitting with whatever arises. But how do you tell someone like do that? How do you talk about Zen? It's difficult. Alan last night quoted from the Tao Te Ching. The first, he said, I'm paraphrasing, the Tao that can be named is not the Tao. The way that can be named is not the way. The one that can be named is not the one. Just naming it is to defile it. When you can talk about one, the moment you do so, you've made it into two. And so, in our practice, we sit. And we sit, and we sit. Until the sun comes through the window. Until we can feel it on our back. We can sense it through our eyes. And we don't have to say anything. But we inevitably do. And so, we ring, listen to the bell, hear the clappers, and sit some more. The great Bodhidharma, the founder of Zen, who went to China from India, said, this is a transmission, this is a teaching, beyond words and text. Of course, we do a lot of reading for something that's beyond words and text. Which is it too. When you look at this koan, and you see these two people, they're two human beings expressing the Dharma, expressing reality. And through that, something is taught. Something changes. Something is transmitted. Not just one way, not just from teacher to student, but from student to teacher. Years and years ago, when I was younger, I had a great interest in guitars. I was a guitar player. I played in bands and I wanted to make a career out of it. And at one point, I thought I could build guitars. I wanted to be a luthier. I had built quite a few electric guitars, but they were quite easy. You just had to buy a big piece of wood and a neck from a manufacturer and throw some strings and a pickup on there. And if you could align and use some few tools and align them up, you could play it. Anything sounded good through a Marshall stack with a distortion box. But I also wanted to be a luthier to build acoustic guitars. Real pieces of craftsmanship, real pieces of wood that resonated. I had played some beautiful guitars. I worked in a music store, E. Wurlitzer Music on Newbury Street in Boston. And I had played some Martins and some Guilds and beautiful instruments. So I wanted to do that. And I read all the books on how to do that, got some tools, got some pieces of wood, and it didn't come out quite the way I wanted to. It sounded more like the guitar that I first built sounded like a shoebox with with elastic bands on it. So I thought, well, if I couldn't learn it from a book, maybe a teacher. And I found a teacher who lived about an hour and a half from me. And when I inquired, he was an elderly man. Well, that's relative. I think he was in his 70s. But, you know, at the time, I thought he was kind of old and he'd retired. And he was from Italy and he didn't speak a lot of English. So I dealt with his wife. And she said, yeah, reluctantly he would take me as a student, but I'd have to pay for 6 months of lessons up front. It's a hefty, hefty amount of money at the time. And I went once a week for a couple hours to work on trying to build guitars. Now, I did mention this guy didn't speak much English. Very little. And maybe he spoke more, but he just didn't speak to me. We set up these pieces of wood on our workbench, and he would go about his business doing stuff and just kind of expect me to work along with him. And whenever I asked him questions about how to do this, how to do that, he would say, oh, it's an old trick from the old country, or some really, really vague instructions. And it got really frustrating. And toward the end, I went every single week, but toward the end, something happened. I might have been a little closer to being a luthier, but realizing I didn't want to be a luthier, but I was building more than guitars. Working alongside him in the sawdust, working with the tools, something transmitted a love for natural things. The smell of wood, appreciation for tools, and just the love of art and artistry and artisanship. I can't say I ever walked away from that with any sort of valuable skill that I could do anything with, other than this deep appreciation for human beings and their capacity to make things and create. And I could say the same thing about Zen. Sitting here with these amazing teachers next to me and these amazing people in this room, I can't actually say that I've learned a skill here. But in many respects, I've become a human being that I can be in touch with. I can, as David Roshi says, have a basic friendliness to myself. And that in itself expands into the world. And so when I investigate this 10,000 dharmas returning to the one, where does the one return to? I can't put it into words, but I can put it into a smile, a bow. Does oatmeal taste delicious today? And that one makes all the difference. So a monk asked Zhaozhou, the 10,000 dharmas return to the one, where does the one return to? And Zhaozhou said, when I was in Qingzhou, I made a cloth robe. It weighed 7 pounds. Thank you. So, folks in the back, could you please come forward and from the the peanut gallery over there? And this is our opportunity to ask questions and raise your hand, and then Alan and David Roshi will answer. Well,
let's just wait till we all get set.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry. There we go. Thanks.
So I guess I have two questions, but I probably don't get to. So I'll just take the first one and comment. 7 pounds seems like a heavy robe.
7 pounds, yeah.
I mean, I don't know, but even weighing your clothes seems a little weird to me. And I don't know if there's an explanation for this or not, but that's not really my main question. My main question is about what would we mean by return? Mm. Return to, I guess it's sort of, you know, it's not about something in time, right? Because then it would be like, well, now you're away, but later on you'll be reunited, right? So it can't be that. I guess the only thing I can think of is it's sort of like everything's made out of the same oatmeal. And when you remember that, or acknowledge it, or something. But I don't know.
Is what is return? So when you hear the word return, what is that like sense for you? When you, not like a meaning, but like when you hear return, what is that?
Well, in this context.
Oh, the context of you, of Will.
Me. Yeah, but me here in this room.
Yeah.
I guess it seems like, you know, I mean, when you are feeling, like I've been feeling very grateful to be sitting with all these people. And when I feel that, it also, kind of attenuates the sense that there's a me and then there's everybody else, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I guess that kind of, I suppose you could call that returning? Mm. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, when I hear it, I can tell you, I think of our website that says welcome home on the homepage. What is, you know, what is home? Welcome, returning home. What is that?
10,000 return to
the one. Another translation of that is come to, the 10,000 come to. But clearly some kind of transformation and a relationship. As we're talking here, I think of taking refuge. Where do I go when it gets difficult? And this constant transformation, one thing becomes the many and many become one, and the morning becomes the afternoon. Where do the 10,000 things go? They go to the one. Where does the one go? This world of coming and going.
Yeah, so that I guess that was part of my question. So I'm used to thinking of the source, but it doesn't matter whether you're coming or going in some sense.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Dix.
Yeah, thanks for the talk. I think it's really easy to start thinking about these things, like, philosophically. And that's something I think has been a big hindrance for me, is like, I love to think about Zen. That's not really what Zen is about, like, you know? Like, I love thinking about, like, all the different philosophies and, like, the history and whatever, but that's not actually helpful. So, how do you sort of avoid getting stuck in that trap?
You know, maybe it is helpful, it's just not helpful in the way that you would like it to be. So, you reading things about Zen, maybe arouses something in you that's a will to practice, or just opens up more questions, or something else. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that the search for Zen in studying books and words is that it brings something here, you know? As long as what you're searching for, you know you already have.
What happens when you get stuck, though?
Yeah, you get stuck.
And more Zazen. I would recommend going on a sesshin.
There you go.
Right? And then we're kind of stuck. And it becomes a little more clear. Right? It becomes clear that how painful it is, or how empty. You know, we think we have something. And in some ways on sesshin, whatever we think we have eventually dissolves. Right, I've really got it now, right? Right, and then that will dissolve, right? And so there is something failing. Michael started talking about mind maps, right? And Buddhism is a lovely mind map, right? But it is not the thing itself. To be at the place where you are frustrated and stuck and you have no way forward and no way back, this is quite a lovely and a fecund place. This is the territory.
If I could add something too, again from the Song of the Grassroots Hermitage, you know what, it says, meet the ancestral teachers, be familiar with their teaching. So we're not supposed to shun the ancient teachers. But it also doesn't say, read the ancestral teachers, there'll be a quiz tomorrow. You know, it says, meet them. Read them in a way that you're able to meet them. Study with the aim to really getting to know the teachers and meeting them in some place that where your mind meets their mind. And then it goes on, buying grasses to build a hut, and don't give up. And so, you know, don't live in a book. Make your hut and practice in it. Or as David said, come to sesshin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Madhu.
Yeah. So, you know, I was, the way that I understood it is, you know, so if we say that emptiness is only empty, then it's kind of like missing the point, right? Because it is so full. Hmm. And that's what I felt like what Zaljo was trying to point out. And I think that's also what you were talking about, Michael, right? Because when a human being becomes a human being, then, you know, they get up in the morning, brush their teeth, and they go to work. We come to sesshin and, you know, we do what we need to do. And I was also thinking about the line of tears, the purple thread or the red thread, and you know how our heart is full. And I was thinking about my daughter, relationships, and you know the fullness of life is what came.
Yeah, your heart is full. Yeah, and the word. For me, the emptiness is a bit troubling. I think it's a translation of this word shunyata, you know, and which doesn't exactly mean empty as voidness. It's empty of something that's not unchanging. So it's this. It's fullness is just a, to me is just a good a term to use. Yeah.
Empty of concepts.
Brad.
there's talk of deaths and rebirths, and not just 100 lifetimes of them because of saying something stupid, but every moment. And I get the rebirth part, like I'm aware when I come back into the present, and I'm aware when I hear a sound, and so it's like a string of birth, 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 and I don't know if the death is important in practice. To notice, maybe it's to notice, you know, the bulk of you tapping the end of a chant or something. It's that's symbolic of it, but should I care about death, or just should I try to be present to the next moment?
What do you care about?
I care about the next moment, you know. I care about this moment. One of our, we had two sister cats and had to put one away right before Christmas, and she was the hunter that would bring stuff to the door, and so one of my daughters suggested that we bring her outside. I'm sorry. Just on the grass before we took her.
Yeah.
And she kind of perked up.
Yeah. Right. So this is it here, Brad. Right. The death. Now thinking of this dear cat, this fierce hunter, carrying her daughter, says, let's take her outside once more. And we cry our tears at what is gone, because it's no small matter to lose what we have, to lose pets that are dear, to lose people, to lose parts of ourself that we have been holding on to. So our Zen way is not a way of thinking positive and staying focused on it'll be okay. It'll be okay. Taking the dear family cat outside for one more time, and she thinks maybe another mouse. I'll get one more mouse. And so this is the dying, so essential, again and again and again. Yeah, thank you so much for manifesting. Yeah.
Sabrina.
I was particularly moved when you brought up the courage that it takes to open yourself to a teacher, and I don't know why.
Yeah. Courage, I'm not a very, I don't know a lot about the meaning of the word, but there's heart in there. I think cur has the root of heart and open-heartedness. Yeah, to open that up, to break open.
In Michael's a story, and I love, by the way, you know, Zsa Zsa made a shirt, Michael made a guitar, and now we're throwing it in the pond. In Michael's story, you know, he had to try and fail and realize that he could read book after book and he couldn't make a guitar, and so coming to the teacher was a way of confessing his own ignorance and his own lack of ability to do something on his own that he wanted to do on his own. And I think that's part of the difficulty. You can't, as someone who was a teacher, you know, a college teacher for many years, it's really hard to teach somebody who thinks that they already know and that all they want from you is validation of what they know and what they brought. And it's easy to teach somebody who knows that they don't know at all. And yet, it's hard to admit that. Harder to admit it to yourself, maybe, than to anybody else.
Yeah. So let's all settle back in and get the Zendo back together.